This is the MagicWordPodcast.com.
Hello, this is Scott Wells for the MagicWordPodcast.com. Well, this week we are going to be having a little bit different kind of a guest that I know is somebody that you're going to learn from. We're going to be talking about storytelling and developing your character, and it's not something that we hear very often from a lot of our guests. We talk about other kinds of things, but we kind of got off into a little bit of a tangent on this one, which I know that you're going to learn from, and we'll talk about this here a little bit later. But last week we had Dan Fleshman, who talked about restaurant magic, and you know, I've not had really quite the response in the past with many of my guests until I had Dan Fleshman on, because a lot of people apparently really like him and the kind of stuff that he does and what he was teaching. And so I got a lot of nice responses from listeners out there. And I always recommend that if you want to send something to me to let me know what you think about the guests that I'm having, that if you'll just go to themagicwordpodcast.com, and there you'll see a comment section below each of the blogs and give you an opportunity to say something, whatever that you happen to think, good, bad, or indifferent, or if you want to hear more of that or less of that type of conversation or that topic or someone else you suggest that we might have, then that's fine too. Or you can write me directly. Just send an email to scott@themagicwordpodcast.com. Along that line, by the way, too, that I have been getting a few responses and as a result of me asking for some people to come back to me and let me know what they, if they have some stories that they would like to share where they have gotten into magic a little bit later in life. It seems that the majority of people have gotten involved in magic when they were quite young, and then they kind of, anyhow, most people are younger. And so I'm looking for stories of people who had gotten into magic later in life and kind of what they have done with it, or rather what it was that kind of got them interested to begin with, and then what they have done with it, what they plan to do with it, and how it really affected your life. You don't have to be a professional, but it could be somebody or something that developed into a very avid hobby of different kinds of things. Some people go off and become collectors, or they might necessarily not be a performer, but they like to do other kinds of things that have to do with magic. Anyhow, I'd like to hear from you. I'd like to hear some of your stories. And so if you'll just send me an email, if you're interested in being on the podcast, I'm going to have about 10 or 12 people perhaps in total that will have some of these conversations and just answering those questions. How old were you when you first got involved with magic? And also, what was it that you saw that interested you the first time? And then what are you doing with it now or plan to do with it? So just kind of give me a quick synopsis and an email to scott@themagicwordpodcast.com, and I will try to set up an appointment with you when we can actually do a recording, perhaps over Skype, be the best way of trying to do that. So I, again, want to thank all of you listeners who have responded to that already, and also that we had a contest last week that Dan Fleshman had offered us a couple of his two DVD sets that we are offering. And if you are hearing this podcast now for the first time and you haven't yet entered that contest, if you'll go back to that episode, you will, on the blog, there is a form that you can fill out so this way that you can enter the contest for a chance to win one of those DVDs. And if you live in the United States, where we can send this domestically, then there'll be no charge for shipping. But if you have a foreign address outside of the U.S. and we have to pay for foreign postage, then we'll let you know what that cost is and you can reimburse this or not. And if you choose not to, then we'll just draw another name. So I encourage everybody to go over to themagicwordpodcast.com to that episode and with Dan Fleshman and fill out the form, and good luck to you. Also, not only good luck to you, but happy birthday to me. Today is my birthday, November 21st. And I thank you, all the people who have been sending me good wishes on Facebook and also emails and whatnot like that. But if you feel particularly magnanimous that you want to help out, this would be a good day for you to become a friend of the Magic Word and send us a donation, or better yet, to pledge a certain amount, doesn't matter, from $1 to $100 a month or whatever that you, I know, wishful thinking, it's my wishes, right? that you can become a friend of the Magic Word, get some pretty cool perks, and help this podcast to continue far into the future. Thank you guys very much who have contributed in the past. I thank you for being a friend of the Magic Word, and also thank you for those of you who are listening from week to week, which makes us very happy. I appreciate that. Well, now we get into this week's guest, and his name is Mark Connolly Wilson. That's not to be confused with the Mark Wilson from the Magic Land of Alakazam. I know that it could be confusing, but this is the lesser-known one who actually had developed a character called Merlin the Wise that he uses at Renaissance festivals. Here in the Texas area, outside of Austin, there's one called the Scarborough Fair, and he performs as Merlin the Wise. And the way he developed this character was, and does some storytelling and everything else is kind of the point of our conversation that we were having. Again, Mark Connolly Wilson is not someone who, he is a magician, but a musician, and also an actor, been in some movies as well as producer, director, and he teaches acting as well at the college here in Austin, Texas. And so anyhow, he is someone that you may not know, but after you hear this podcast, you'll have a new friend and also some new knowledge that you'll learn from someone who is a master storyteller. So please welcome my guest this week, Mr. Mark Connolly Wilson, here on The Magic Word. Hello, this is Scott Wells for TheMagicWordPodcast.com, and I am here today with Merlin the Magician. This is pretty fantastic, you know, that to go back in history that long ago to talk with someone who is that old and he looks so much younger. You've held your age there, Merlin.
Well, it depends on what historical depiction of Merlin you go with. Of course, I don't always sound like this. I change my voice depending on what I'm doing. I just view myself as from way back when, and now I'm getting younger, so I don't really have to pay attention to how old I am anymore.
Way back when?
Yes. Okay. A long time ago when the world was young.
And were you friends with the Druids?
Yes, Druids and from the Isle of Avalon, of course, all the enchantresses and sorceresses and all that. And we always make jokes about, you know, what wizards do and enchantresses do and sorceresses do.
And what do they do?
Enchantresses is enchant, sorceresses source, and I am a wizard, you see. So and you we just stop there. It's, you got to remember, I perform at that Renaissance festival quite a lot. And the real question is, how long do I need to talk like this?
Okay, well, and of course, it is Scottish as opposed to being English or
it's
Irish.
It's Welsh, Scottish, Irish. It's sort of a mixture there. Okay. If you want to look up, listen to a bit of Billy Connolly.
Sure.
He sings only like that, Billy Connolly, all the time like that. He's sort of up and happy. And I didn't pattern my voice after him, but it ended up being like that when I realized later in retrospect that the voice I was trying to do, being from Texas, of course, I don't sound like this. But I sound more like a hillbilly. No, I don't sound like a hillbilly either. But when I started listening to the voice, I'll let it melt away there, I realized that Billy Connolly was pretty close to what I was shooting for.
Right.
So that's what I now go back to as a reference.
I wonder if the British kind of think of his accent as being what we in the U.S. consider to be like a Midwestern accent. In other words, that those people who are like on television, you know, in the movies that have an accent, let's say of Chicago or, like you say, maybe in the Tennessee Hills or maybe in New York or even in California, you can tell. However, those people who are newscasters tend to have, like myself, I'm from the Midwest, so I've got, I think, a Midwestern accent.
And yes.
People say, no, you got an accent, man. You know?
Yeah, yeah. No, it's the same there as it is here. They have different regions and different dialects.
Sure.
I have a great story. Stories, I assume, are in line here.
Yeah, please
do. So I do many things besides being Merlin. A lot of audio production in my background and video production and such. So voice casting and recording voiceover for commercial material,
right.
Commercial pieces. So one particular client, guy I'd worked with, called me up. He said, hey, I need you to cast a guy to do the narration. My clients are from Scotland, and they need someone that can – but they want to market this to an Irish demographic. So okay. We need someone who's Irish to do the voiceover. Well, all I knew is I had personally had been working with a guy in Dallas, Scotch Productions. I've forgotten the gentleman's name. It's been so many years since I contacted him and worked with him directly. But I used him all the time back in the day in the early 90s. And so I called up my friend. I want to say his name was Gordon. And I knew that he had an amazing Irish accent and an amazing Scottish accent. He wasn't American. He was obviously from over there somewhere.
It was a genuine accent.
He was a genuine accent.
Okay.
The thing is, I didn't really know, because I didn't at the time understand the dialects that well. I just knew he wasn't from America. And everything I heard sounded amazing. And so I said, can we have an Irish? Oh, yeah, no problem. You know, and he did a quick thing and I went, oh, that's wonderful. And so we recorded all the voiceover. It was done. You know, I just sent him a copy. He recorded it, sent it to me. I sent it to my client. And then I got a call a week later and the guy says, we got a problem. He goes, well, my clients are Scottish and they, as soon as I played the file for them, they went, he's not Irish. And they started laughing and they stood up in the boardroom and actually had a map and they pulled down the map and they said, he's from this village right here, this little fishing village right here on the coast. And they knew the exact village he was from in Scotland because his Irish accent wasn't real to them.
Sure.
To us Americans, it was fine, you know, no problem. I've got another quick
and the other story.
I have two or three stories. I always tell them in succession. They kind of go together. Just things that pop in my mind that because everything's sort of related. One of my being a fan of film and all that, I grew up watching the original Lost in Space with Jonathan Harris. You remember boy William, my boy, you know, Jonathan Harris. He's from the Bronx. Okay. Mm-hmm. That accent we hear him do as Dr. Smith is his best attempt at an English accent. He never could shake his Brooklyn accent, so to speak. So what he did was he neutralized it by trying to do an English accent, which he failed at. But it was this very classy, sharp, you know, I love the way he sounded. So there you go.
Yeah. Well, I'm glad we talk about movies because I'm a movie fanatic also, and I'm sure there'll be some references before this conversation's over we might kind of go in and out of. But also, for those who are listening, that not only is it go by Merlin Magician, but my guest here today, of course, is Mark Wilson.
Yes, Mark Conley Wilson. I'm an actor. I'm a musician. Magician, again, for many years. I graduated high school in 1980, so, you know, about that time I started doing shows professionally. And in 2009, I believe, I started a Renfair career as a magician. And I would say that's when I really truly...
You weren't acting as Merlin at that time. You were just kind of doing
audition. Yeah, I just did standard, you know, tuxedo, mm-hmm. short hair, birthday parties.
Tuxedo? Wait. You didn't wear a tuxedo, obviously, for the Renfest.
Not for Renfair. No, up until that point, I did the standard magician thing. You know, I did birthday parties. I did occasional mm-hmm. walk around. And it was pretty silly kid stuff,
standard
stuff, you know. Dressed in standard mm-hmm. magician clothes. And 2009, there was an ad listing on one of the news feeds and one of the email lists. Hey, this Renaissance Festival is starting called Sherwood Forest Fair. It's in the Austin area, which is where I lived.
Austin, Texas.
It's actually in McDade, Texas. McDade, Texas is where it's located. It's just near Elgin, between Elgin and Giddings, off of 21 there. Or near 21.
So 21 all your stories go down rat holes like this?
Yes, they do. I do segue, yes. Okay. Trying to think aloud. Anyway, they saw the email and they said, hey, we're casting for this. We need a Robin Hood. We need a Sir Guy of Gisborne. We need Lady Marian. Oh, and we need Merlin the Wise. And Merlin the Wise will have his own show, so he needs to be a magician.
Mm-hmm.
And so I looked in the mirror and went, I took a black and white photo, put a hood over my head and sent that in.
What year would this have been approximately?
This would be about 2008, I think, yeah.
Were you gray-haired then?
I had basically, the hair had already gone gray, but I hadn't grown it out to see how much.
Uh-huh.
I've always had this young look, young face with old hair.
Okay.
I got that from my mother. She went prematurely gray when she was 18. And sure enough, they wrote back and said, yeah, that we can see that working with the look.
Mm-hmm.
And then, of course, can I do the magic? Can I do entertainment? And I barely could at the time. And they came out, watched the show and said, okay, I can see that. And either no one else applied or they saw something there and said this could happen. And I began my career as a Renaissance Festival magician playing Merlin.
So the kind of magic that you were auditioning with, was it pedestrian kind of trick?
It was just...
I mean,
kids
they
show.
Themed to
it,
the
Renaissance. Yeah, it was kids show. It was clown stuff. It was just being silly, old, inept magician guy, you know. And that's really – and there's a whole discussion about the philosophies that I have now versus what I had then.
Which is why we're here.
And the change and all that, which could take more than this podcast. I'll let you drive that. Yeah.
Well, I am interested because it's not just about that, but also about storytelling and developing a character, which I really think that a lot of people are interested in doing because that makes people care. And that's perhaps the most important thing I think about magic, and that is of not just doing something that, as Michael Marr would say, would be bubblegum for the eyes, but what is it that's going to be, you know, some good protein for the brain, basically, you know?
Yes.
And so it's that storytelling that drives it, that makes people interested in watching and caring about that.
And we often, when I have conversations with other magicians and other people related to magic, you know, it's one of those things where in general, most people will nod their head and say, yes, yes, it's important. It's what we need to do. And they understand it and they don't disagree. But in practice, you see more magicians not following that and not trying to put that in their act and not really remembering that when they design their act and when they pick their effects and when they, because again, the effects shouldn't matter, right? This is this is the goal. The goal is, and I'm no different than them, by the way. So don't think that I'm stating that I am the master of this process.
We all try to practice what we preach, but
I do really understand it, and I do really, you know, want it to happen, and I am working toward that constantly.
Uh-huh.
But yeah, the normal thing is, wow, look at this cool trick. How can I stick that in? Mm-hmm. And really, you should design the act with none of that stuff. Tell the story, be the character, then plug in the magic, you know, if you can.
At least. So is that what you try to do now?
In general. That's the process right now. Sometimes an effect will be like, oh, that effect is great. That gives me this idea. Now how can we make a story related to that? You know, it might run the other way. But in general, and this doesn't just come from me. I have a director. I have someone who directs my show.
You're a lucky guy.
I'm a lucky guy. And it's a friend. Mm-hmm. And he goes by the stage name of Saul Ravencraft. And Saul Ravencraft does not do magic. He is a paranormal entertainer. He goes down the rabbit hole, right?
Yeah, and he's got his own radio broadcast.
He's got his own radio podcast and all that. And he's got a background. He's done the standard magician thing. Mm-hmm. He did that for years. He knows how to do all the slides and all the stuff.
And he runs the museum in Austin.
He appears at the Museum of the Weird in Austin, Texas, as Saul Ravencraft. Mm-hmm. And he does tours for the museum and their little kind of interesting artifacts there.
But the fact that you've got a director and that you recognize you need to have a director, that's really important. Not everybody has it. Number one, most magicians don't have a place where they can regularly perform so they can practice and get better, because we need to have flight time. Number two is to have someone who subjectively and objectively can see your act and make suggestions as to what to improve, and you need to, you know, your choreography and blocking, etc.
And in the case of my Renfro act, he's actually in the act because that was part of what happened, but that's okay. He actually plays Archimedes the Owl. And that was necessary, and that was his own invention. He said,
"He doesn't dress as an owl. He's got like a
has an owl puppet, and he wears a hood, and so you don't see his face. And he calls it the meat puppet. And basically, the Archimedes is captivating enough that no one pays attention to the guy behind the hood, you know. And the whole goal there was, you know, back to the bumbling magician in trouble, senile, inept wizard." Kind of route that a lot of people take, you know, magician in trouble, that whole thing. He said, you know, you need someone that makes Merlin be dignified. We need to take all that trouble away from Merlin and make someone else be the troublemaker. So basically Archimedes is the one who does all the wisecracks. He's the one that causes the trouble, the mischief maker. Merlin knows is our mantra. Merlin knows. And so Merlin remains dignified. And now, he causes the problems.
So
and
Merlin's not a buffoon.
I'm the straight guy. Yeah. I'm not a buffoon. Exactly. Yeah. And whereas before, if I'm by myself on stage, I can be entertaining. I naturally have that, you know, kind of basic ability. Mm-hmm. I can do some stuff and I can be entertaining, but I might fall back on being a buffoon.
Yeah. It's easy to do that.
It's easy to do that. And and Merlin, of all characters in, you know, literature, probably shouldn't be a buffoon. He should have some dignity at some point, you know.
Well, yeah.
So we try to go there. We try to keep it there, and Archimedes helps make that happen. So
when you're developing the character, again, you have the story first, and then the tricks that are coming next. But it sounds like that once they hired you, you had already had some tricks. How did that?
We changed the way we presented some of the stuff we had, and then we took things that should be presented one way, and we changed the way we presented them. You know, for instance, a real simple example would be I've got to go back to what, you know, my magic history. What do you call that thing that I've been doing? I forget what it's called. You know, silks, the silks jumping around, and what's the official word of that effect? I forget. Sean Begonia stuff.
Oh, you're talking about the Dancing Hank?
Yeah, Dancing Hank. Yeah, thank you. Okay. Dancing Hank. The classical name is Dancing Hank. And I'm familiar. Like, I saw Calvert set up and, you know, Fred Donaldson and all that, you know. But yeah, all with those setups. So the Dancing Hank, and there's different ways that can be done. And I have several versions. But the Hank itself, the actual scarf, became the baby dragon. The dragon can camouflage itself, and so now it looks like a scarf. And so now we're chasing this baby dragon around.
And so that's kind of a thematic or a running...
The story, the script of the current show that we're doing right now, this story is called Merlin and the Dragon. That's the name of the script. And it is written by my friend who does... his name is Chris Walden, by the way. Yeah. He performs as Saul Ravencraft. He wrote the script and basically took these things that we had, these sort of disjointed pieces of magic, and made them into a cohesive story.
Right.
Yeah.
Now, do you keep the same story? Or do you change that year after year?
I mean, no, that's the act. It's an act. Okay. It is scripted. I could sit here and rattle off all my lines.
But when people come back year after year, it's the same script.
For a period of time, we do change it. Every few years,
because you have some of the same people come back. Obviously,
I have the same people come back year after year. I have fans out in the community who come in and hire me for private events because they saw me at Sherwood. That whole thing. We kind of view sometimes performing in the Renaissance environment as part marketing,
of course,
a rehearsal and part marketing,
But is that proprietary? In other words, that the dragon thing, for an example, that you would do in the context of the...
Currently it is, because there are a couple moments in the show that depend upon the stage. And until we devise methods for delivering some of that stuff elsewhere, it's not sensible to do portably and move from venue to venue. Now, excerpts of the show and big blocks of it, we can do anywhere.
Plug and play. So it's not, again, that you don't require that, hey, this stays here kind of a thing.
It's really just because we've been doing that particular show 2 years now, right? With the only change being a few ad-lib lines that we document and add into the line, add into for the humor,
Right. Now, whenever that, before the Merlin had come, isn't this the same place where that Markham had performed?
I don't know. No, he'd never performed at this fair, because I've been there since it opened, but it's the same kind of venue, because Renaissance fairs are everywhere.
I know they're every place.
Yeah, in every state.
This is Scarborough Fair?
Scarborough Fair might have been where Markham was.
That's where he was.
I believe
and
it was.
You
that's
are
in
at...
So Scarborough Fair is commonly known as Scarby Fair. That's in Waxahachie, Texas. Mm-hmm. I am at Sherwood Forest Fair, which is in McDade, Texas, and it's between outside of Austin, kind of between Austin and Giddings. So you're heading on 290. Yeah.
And the Scarborough Fair was the one, which is actually closer up to Fort Worth.
Closer to Dallas, Florida. Correct.
And then, of course, the
Renaissance
Festival.
Which is where the number one official Merlin, we all like to call him Bill Palmer. He was at Texas Renaissance Festival since like the 80s, I believe.
Right. I think he was there for about 25 years before he finally retired and hung it up.
He'd
kind of done everything. And yeah, he was really the ultimate. And Bill Palmer was
there. And I know him. And my friend Chris, who does Saul Ravencraft, actually knows him quite well. And so we share notes from time to time. I did have the opportunity to perform with him one night and be on the same stage with him when he was doing a lecture out at Richard Garriott's property there at his recreation of the globe. Which is really cool.
Before he moved to New York, he come back ever?
Yeah, I don't know if he ever came back. I haven't checked in with him in a while.
Because I know that Brad Henderson was a curator of all of his magic museum.
Yes.
Did that go with him, or is some of that still in?
I don't know. I talked to him a couple times at a couple of meetings, and of course, I actually had met Richard years ago. We're talking of Richard Garriott, of course, who went
Richard
to the
Garriott,
moon.
Who was an astronaut, and he was also the creator of a gaming company.
Yes, he had his own company. And did a lot of famous things back in the video game industry. And that's where I started my other career as a video game composer. I do music for video games and film and stuff. So I had met him years before. Mm-hmm. And then he got involved in the local Austin Magic community. And then I got to, get to know him a little better there.
Yeah.
But the last I know is I have the number for the volunteer fireman who manages his property out there. And that's still on my phone. And it's the last I've connected.
Had any interaction with him or anything.
He let us borrow. He actually, Richard let us, was very kind. He let us borrow a little microbus or a little van, I should say, to go to Branson, Missouri, where a bunch of the magicians from Austin area loaded in this little van and drove to Branson, Missouri, where we were shown the town by Peter, the Adequate. Gave us tours of Branson, and we went to see all the different theaters and magicians there. So that was been a number of years. I think Ramon Galindo was with us. It was a fun little trip.
Yeah, and Ramon Galindo is another fellow, by the way, that, I would love to get a chance to talk with him, because he's, 94, 5,
Yeah, he's
6?
Getting up there.
He is, and he was the one who, I think, started Parakeet Magic.
Yes.
And also was a tailor, and had made a lot of wonderful clothing and everything, with toppets and bird pockets and everything like that.
Yeah, I actually failed on going and getting a gift. He said he would give me a gift of a certain suit he had that he thought would fit me that had toppets and such already installed, and I never did hook up and get over there to get it in time. So, and at this point, the problem is I don't really perform in normal street clothes.
Right.
So I have custom costumes. My lady, who's also helps me in my show, she is my seamstress. She's made me you know, two or three outfits now.
I was going to say, when you're out there in the heat, they probably. I remember, for an example, after Markham had died and they had some of his costume things, they were just in shreds. You can just imagine with the,
it's rough.
The sweat and everything.
It's rough, yeah.
He can only wash him so many times.
It's a rough environment. It's not It's not for everyone.
When people ask you questions, I guess, you know, like, as Merlin, I mean, did you move Stonehenge? I mean, like, the real guy? I mean...
You just kind of come back with answers, you know.
So have you done a lot of research, obviously?
A little bit. I mean, the good news about a character like Merlin is it's very open. I did enough research to realize that in many areas it doesn't really matter.
Yeah.
I remember Bill Palmer advising me on this same topic. He was saying basically that, you know, people will start talking to you in Welsh, you know, or in Gaelic, I should say, in Gaelic. And it's like, well, don't you understand Gaelic? They're trying to, you know, show.
Of course, yeah.
He said, well, of course I understand Gaelic, but I mean, why, you know, we're here among all these other people and it wouldn't be rude to speak in a language that, you know.
Unknown to.
So you just come up with some responses for that stuff. But for the most part, all I care is I'm dealing with sort of two masters or three masters. I'm dealing with my director, I'm dealing with myself, and I'm dealing with the fair. And the fair environment typically has a very historical, our entertainment director is very much about everything being period accurate. Okay. Mm-hmm. And that is because we're set in a very specific time period. It's Sherwood.
How does that? Oh, so
Richard the Lionheart. It's Robin Hood. It's so that time period is nothing to do with Merlin. So Merlin's already out of time by being there.
Right.
So it doesn't really matter what I do in that environment because I'm magically there. I can get away with more stuff in terms of period accuratenness than other performers can.
But they're expecting you because it is a, quote, Renfest kind of
correct
thing that is part of the nationwide chain, and people may have been to one in Colorado, wherever they're thinking.
Well, there are different types of people that attend Ren Fair. We have patrons, we have patrons, we have, you know, and then what, there's reenact.
Patrons?
Patrons, yeah, patrons and patrons. You know, and a patron, you know, a patron pays and comes in. They may dress up, they may not.
Yeah.
A patron goes full out. They dress just, you can barely tell that they're not on cast.
Like cosplay.
Yeah, okay. Right. And then you know, the joke is a stormtrooper in a kilt. So you'll see everything from a stormtrooper in a kilt to
seriously
period reenactment, you know.
Wow.
Yeah.
Okay.
It's a different environment.
Yeah.
And for magicians, it's very different. The performing environment is different. It's a totally different measure of success, I guess. Mm-hmm. And that's where I feel like I am different even than other Ren Fair performers. Like my goals for what I want to consider to be a good show are very different than what I would consider a standard magic show.
Now, I understand that at most Ren festivals, that they, Renaissance festivals, they allow for tipping. I assume that this is the same.
Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
Which is part of a big thing. So basically, you're a street performer.
You're a street performer. You know, we get a base rate, though. I wouldn't be there if there wasn't a base rate.
Okay,
so
sure.
Base rate. But then, yeah, we want to get that tip and build the tip and get as much as we can.
What's your best advice for
and
that?
And we do, well, backroom sales. You know, we sell little magic wands, you know, mm-hmm. So if you're donating. We're not selling. We're donating, of course.
Yeah.
There are little sticks with little ribbons and little characters sewn on or tied on. And that really increases the hat because we basically say you're going to put a $5 bill in there. If you put a $5 or more, take one of these wands with you. You know, and the wand costs under a dollar to make.
Yeah.
And people will, more than often than not, they'll put in that extra money, put in a 10.
Because I remember Bill Palmer talking, he'd take off his conical hat, you know, and then we'd have a wand saying, I'm going to make this into a receptacle for money. You know, let me show you what I mean. Please put some money in there.
Yeah, always jokes and different things. We've tried different things, you know, different ways to build that. But it's kind of a combination of, you know, we end the show on that high beat. We turn the dragon. Of course, now it's time. It's time. It's time. And of course, Archimedes says, it's time for the dragon to eat the children. And Merlin copies him and says, it's time for the dragon to eat what? No, wait a minute. Archimedes. He's like, oh, sorry. You know, no, but you do make me think, well, one of us has to. That dragon, he's very dangerous as he is. You know, I think we should convert him into something more suitable for interaction with the children, don't you think? You know, and so we bring out the dragon, which is a scarf, and we put him in a tip over.
Okay.
And I play the fiddle, and everyone claps along, and we poof, and there's the rabbit, you know. And it's just that part is just like a magic show.
Right.
And that we end with the rabbit and everyone goes, oh, goody, the rabbit. And if you'd like to meet the dragon, make a single file line here. As you step forward to meet him, drop your donation in the basket. You know, it's all scripted.
Right, right. And how long is the act itself?
About 45 minutes.
And how many tricks would you say? Tricks.
Oh,
you know,
boy. That's really hard. I would have to spend more time.
Dozen or so?
I'm going to have to... I can't even guess.
Okay.
I never thought of it in that term.
I know, right? You don't.
And that is the common note from the director is tricks per minute. We don't think in terms of tricks per minute, because that's what a lot of magicians do.
Thinking in terms of laughs per minute. That's what I do.
It's about laughs per minute. Yeah. It is about laughs. And here's the other thing, very important.
LPM.
Because I am in a Renaissance Festival environment, even though I'm in the, quote, children's area, my stage is in the children's area, I am performing for the adults. I personally am performing a show that is fun for the kids, but I am performing to the adults.
Like my jokes, all my jokes.
I'm not fooling. I'm not trying to fool the adults. I'm trying to entertain the adults. And all my jokes are way up here, adult humor that is completely masked where you would never see anything bad. And I'm trying to make sure they're having a good time.
Kind of a double entendre, I guess.
Double entendre. Okay. Yeah. And if they, if they are having a good time and they get some of our little jokes, and not all of them are dirty. I mean, some of them are, one of the more funny ones I feel is I simply read. I'm going to make a scroll appear.
Okay.
And I say the magic words to make the scroll appear. Loren Ipsen Dolor Sit Amet. And there's like one person who laughs a full out guffaw and falls over. And then Archimedes goes, there's always one that gets it, you know, and it's, it has to do with if you do, typesetting and that's the, the dummy text they would use to set the type.
Yeah.
And people that are in the either computer side or in the old, they'll get that joke. But I have to say something to make the, for the incantation.
Right.
So why not make it a bit? And it's a small bit. It doesn't appeal to the mass audience, but a couple of people get it and laugh, you know.
That's kind of like a joke that I have heard, I've used occasionally to gauge the level of the audience. And that is how many surrealists does it take to change a light bulb? Fish.
Very nice.
If they laugh, it's like, oh, yeah. Got a hip
on. So my, back to the kind of the core conversation, we sort of headed down that path about, you know, character and show. So my first advice I got from Chris Walden, who is Saul Ravencraft, is that we should standardize what we call him, by the way, so I don't keep jumping back and forth.
Since you're out of character as Merlin, he should be out of character as Saul.
He should be Chris.
Okay.
Chris Walden. His first bit of advice was just be Merlin. Well, what trick? Don't worry about any of that. Just be Merlin. And he kind of said that like that to me for about a year.
Okay. Even though people may call you Santa.
That's right. And I do that too, of course, because, I have the look for the beard and such. I just trim it up a bit.
Both seasons.
Yeah. But then I get to be an English Santa. You know, it's different.
Oh, that's interesting.
Yes.
Okay.
See, words like laboratory and things like that, you know. So be Merlin, and then we wrote a script, and then we took the tricks and formed them into a story, you know. The dragon, we brought you a dragon. We're going to show you the dragon. We open the cage, and the dragon flies out, and before we can do it, he flies out of the cage and knocks a stand over, and he's gone invisible, and now we got to find him. And that's how it starts.
I see. So I create a little bit of drama to begin with.
Total
something
drama.
Happening, and then you have that as a running theme.
Crash,
throughout.
Bang, boom.
Sure. That's really good. That's good. And the storytelling is something I think is really important. That was what we were talking about a few moments ago before we actually started to talk about on the podcast here with this. And we were talking about how that you have to have emotion. It's better to sell emotion than it is a trick. So this way people will remember that.
Well, yeah, the whole thing is you have to get your audience to be invested in what happens to the characters. This all comes from, you know, filmmaking and storytelling. I teach filmmaking. I worked at, you know, in that world as an actor, both in film and such. And then the stage stuff is something I kind of always did on the side. And music is something I did on the side. I kind of have all these different disciplines that seem disconnected that as I more and more I do it, the more I realize they're all the same job. It's just different parts of the same job. But you have to go back to context to give your audience some context so they care about what happens to the characters. It's really that simple. I actually was told a story by Chris Walden about a show that Max Maven did that he saw where Max came out and basically flipped a coin and talked about, you know, I assume this is very, very long ago. My memory may not be accurate. If you know what I'm talking about, I do apologize, Max, if you hear this. But something about, you know, is it fate? Is it probability? What chance? Whatever. And his job, as he described to his audience, apparently was to make the audience care on the outcome of that coin toss, the coin flip. Is it heads or is it tails? And then he went on through his show. And at the end of the show, he came back to the coin and said, you'll never know. And the lights went black. And at that moment, the audience members go, ah, he did it to me. I cared.
Yeah.
You know, he succeeded.
Yeah.
And that idea has stuck since hearing that story sort of secondhand, whether I got the facts right or not. The concept is what mattered. The fact that you must care, or otherwise the story is, you know, there's just no point.
Create enough interest that they
care. There's no interest, yeah. Mm-hmm. And so I did a similar thing for a lecture I had to do for a class of editors. So I taught film editing for a while. Post-production is kind of my specialty in film, which is, you know, the editing and sound, and I do music composition and scoring, all that. And I was asked by a friend of mine to go over to a school that she teaches at and talk to her graduating class of editors. And so I put together a presentation, and I took two decks of cards with me, and I had a slideshow that had all my questions. And actually, right before I went to do the presentation, she sent me a list of her questions. So I did have to go through. And so I put those in the slideshow and just answered her questions, basically. But I did it by showing sort of the response to it instead of listing the question, like a good PowerPoint form. I didn't put the question. I just put stuff, and then I segued into the question. Anyway, I came out with the decks, and I said, pick a deck. Pick someone out of the audience. Pick a deck.
Red or blue?
Red or blue. They open up the box. Do like I do, and now we're just going to one-handed just drop cards. And when you feel compelled, just stop on a card. Doesn't
choose a
matter
pill, Neo, red or blue.
Yes, exactly. Choose a pill, yes. And so we end up with two cards. I take the decks, drop them in a receptacle, and leave the two cards on the desk right there where everyone in the room could see it. And I said, basically, we're going to come back to that. Thanks for helping me out. We're going to come back to that. I went on with my presentation. I would come back to those cards at some point. I'd say, okay, now about those cards. What about the process you used? You know, how did you go about selecting that card? I mean, did you just, count a certain number? Did you just kind of wait till you had a feeling? Like, what was there anything behind your process that made you pick that card? You know, which card you stopped at? And we talked about that a little bit. And then I said, that's interesting. You know, we'll come back to that. And what was funny is every time I did this several times as we went through various phases, and each time I would say, we'll come back to that. The audience would chuckle a little more each time.
Mm-hmm.
Because they were like, okay, this is funny. What's he up to? And then I went on with my presentation, and I would come back. Now, what do you think you picked? I mean, you're hoping for a face card? You're hoping for, you know, and then I talked about significance of court cards over, you know, there's
picture
a whole
card, number
history
card.
There, yeah. Which I reviewed right beforehand. So I had something of interest to say about it. Well, we had a little conversation about that, and it turned out the woman's name related to a court card, which led to a queenly thing, which from her history, and she actually pictured a queen.
Mm-hmm.
Very interesting. You know, what do you think if you actually picked a queen? Would that surprise you then? And so then we went on again. Well, we'll come back to that. And another chuckle. And we came back at the very end. And of course, at the end, I picked up the two cards and held them in front of me with facing me where they couldn't see them. And I said, now, what do you think the chances are that our cards match? And we talked about that for a moment. And I said, well, the thing is, it doesn't really matter. We'll never know. And I dropped them in the box. And thank you, Max, for that, by the way. And the audience just gasped and went, wow, you know, and they were like, they got it. At that moment, they got that I had built all this context up, this interaction with this person who I now knew something about. I knew her name. I knew her history. I knew what she was thinking. And it affected them. You know, and I could see that. And I was like, all right, this really is cool. I like this.
I had Alex Pandrea as a guest one time, and he was talking about how that whenever that he will do a card trick after he's done several kinds of things and basically have one card face down, he kind of builds it up the same thing, you know, that what if you would have done this? You know, that all this time we've done such and such and such and such. But basically, you can turn that over and find out if we're right or wrong. And however, if you put that in your purse, or your wallet, and carry it tomorrow and as long as you want and without ever looking at it, you will have a story to tell.
That's right.
So this way that the story may be more interesting than the fact of you knowing what that is. It's kind of like Schrodinger's cat, you know.
So another story that relates to this that's unrelated, which is I just heard this sometime talking about filmmaking, Alfred Hitchcock.
Sure.
Alfred Hitchcock was supposedly known to have said, you know, you show some guys sitting around a table and you put a bomb under the table.
Hmm.
You show the bomb.
Right.
The bomb goes off. You get 3 or 4 seconds of, oh, my God, the bomb blew up. Yeah. You know, oh, my God, that's what you get. Mm-hmm. That's the bang for buck. Mm-hmm. But if you show the bomb and then you show the same guy sitting around the table and they start talking about baseball. And they keep talking about baseball.
Right.
And you're like, don't talk about baseball. There's a bomb.
Don't you guys know there's a bomb?
There's a bomb under the tape, you know, but they're talking about baseball. And you keep showing, you get 10 minutes of or whatever the
tension.
Time was, of tension, right? So you get mm-hmm. a lot more bang for bucks. There's a joke there, bang for buck.
Yeah, but because we want that to be relieved. It's the same. Yeah, I know he uses that all the time.
Yeah.
It, when you see that somebody comes running, you know, somebody jumps in the car and somebody comes running out with a gun, and you can see these guys, you know, ducking down the rear in the back seat, you know, and you see through the window the guy with the gun, but he doesn't, and you're thinking he's going to shoot through the window, and he doesn't, you know. So it's just, you know, you kind of squint your eyes a little bit, like, I know there's going to be a loud bang and nothing happens.
Yeah,
yeah, something's
going
to happen. So the
tension
same kind of there. Thing there, that you kind of build
or
some tension.
They do that where they pull out the gun and then the balloon pops, you know, why they build the tension as a joke, you know, to scare you. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah, something completely different like that.
Phantom of the Paradise, one of my favorite films. They actually argued over this scene, but there's a scene where he, Brian De Palma, of course, known to rip off Hitchcock, you know, in homage. There's a scene where the Phantom, the guy's in the shower, and the Phantom cuts the shower curtain with the knife, and mm-hmm. then all of a sudden you hear a pop, and he takes a plunger and sticks it on his face, and you know, and threatens him, you know, if you ever do this, I'll kill you, you know, or whatever.
Okay.
But he was supposed to do one thing with a knife, and then they argued, and so they compromised by using a plunger.
Okay.
So, but you get a pop, you know, it's kind of scary, but funny at the same time.
That's interesting. Well, you were recently featured also in Kent Cummins' column in the Lincoln Ring Magazine from June.
Yes, he does a marketing magic column every month in the Lincoln Ring, and I was telling some of these stories about the little presentation I'd done. And talking about filmmaking with him one night after a local Ring meeting. And he went, hey, and I'm going to call you, or I'm going to write you, or whatever. And he said, yeah. Can I get a quote? And so I gave him a quote. And the quote was something about what I mentioned earlier, which is, you know, showing the emotional reaction of others to an event helps you build that interest in caring about the character's outcome. You know, what happens as outcome mm-hmm. of that. Mm-hmm. It was something along those lines. It was longer and more well worded, but
have to go back and read the article.
Have to go back and read it. It's probably right here in front of me, actually. What did I say? Yeah. Oh, yeah, here it is. What is important and necessary is to show the emotional reactions that come about as a result of the events that unfold in a story. By building context, we can make the audience care about what happens to our characters, and we can make them feel the emotions more intensely by focusing more on the emotional reactions of the events. Basically, there you go.
So what do you mean by that?
It's kind of what I've been saying. I mean, if you don't care about – well, first off, it's about relating to – because the goal is always to make things more relatable to a wider audience. Mm-hmm. So if you do something that's only to a small audience, you're limiting yourself. So you want to make sure that – I use songwriting as an example. That's something else I do. When you write a lyric – you know, that's why we tend to have all these love songs, because at least people can relate to love songs. You know, it's like we all have that emotion. We all have. If I wrote a song about a very specific thing, then less it wouldn't be as accessible to, you know, the masses. So it's similar to this. When you tell a story, you want to appeal to as many people as you can. They need to have experiences that they can share or relate to. And so by showing the reactions, the emotional reactions that other characters happen as a result of an event, you get more mileage for your time, you know, within the story, and they care more about the characters.
Right.
Does that make sense?
It does make sense. It does make sense. You know, that is something that Penn Jillette, I believe, had talked about. I think he's either had it in a lecture or was in writing. I read this or heard this from somewhere, having to do with about the same thing, basically, of making sure that you appeal to an audience on an emotional level and not necessarily just on a plastic level. It should be something that's deeper. I think that's why that we as magician we'd be using a person's ring for an example. You borrow a finger ring because that's personal. That's something
it's a personal item. Yeah,
right. They carry with them, you know, forever. Well, it seems like it from the time they're married until whenever. But it's something they wear all the time. Is my point. Just like a name. You talk about write your name on a card. You're trying to personalize it.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
You know, it's kind of a poor way of doing
it. My favorite card effect is where you spell their name. What's your name? Mark, M-A-R-K. Well, it didn't work. Oh, wait, it's your name. You spell them out. You
right.
know, and yeah.
Right. Yeah. So it personalizes, I think, because it happens to have something to do with them. Because otherwise, it would be, again, like Michael Moore said, you know, bubblegum for the eyes. It's something that you need to have something that's going to be more of an emotional hook that you have to have that people will remember for a lot longer. Just as you were saying, as you're building the suspense and talking about with the cards, and you'll come back to that a little bit later. So it is kind of become a running theme, because after a while, if they're invested, it's like, I've listened to this so much, there's got to be a payoff here. And the payoff is just the mystery.
Yeah, the payoff, there is no payoff in a way. It's
yeah.
Like, no, you jerk. No, but no, it paints a bigger, it's a more important message.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the thing. I'm trying to, you know, these are potential, in that particular case, it's a class full of editors. Editing is storytelling, right?
Yeah.
And so they need to understand what's important about storytelling. And back to an example I like to use is a death. Let's say you have three main characters who, let's say you watch the film, and because of the way the story's been told, mm-hmm. you have the same amount of knowledge and commitment or investment in each character, all three characters equally. You care about all of them, and then one of them dies.
Okay.
You feel, because that character died, on the level of investment, right? However, if you just, they died and then you move on with the story, you get a little bit of sadness because that character died. However, if you spend time in your story focusing on the other two characters' reaction to the death of the third character, now you take it to a whole other level, because you cared about that character and you cared about these two, but now you're really seeing their agony, how much they're affected by the death of their friend, and it's a whole other level of emotional reaction.
Right, because it's not just your reaction, because yours maybe...
You're living it through them.
Exactly.
Yeah, and you're seeing their agony, their sadness, their, you know, what are they going to do, and how they deal with it, you know.
Well, that might not be a bad idea. Whenever that you have somebody up and something starts to go wrong, then you have an emotional attachment to that. Oh, I'm so sorry. So I've tell you what, I've got something over here that might be a gift for you, you know, to soothe your uneasiness or your sorrow or something.
Yeah, and if you're thinking from a routine standpoint.
Like, yes, yeah. That's what I'm trying to think of, is how that you could actually develop a routine around something has gone awry or wrong, and that you're trying to make it better. So this way the audience feels good about that too. I mean, people don't like to see someone mishandled or mistreated, you know, on stage or anything, which is another thing, by the way. Have you had situations in which there have been some problems on stage with somebody that's come up and maybe gotten ill, or, you know, I mean, with this hot out there, you know, heat stroke? And
in our crew, or someone in the audience?
I'm talking from the audience, you know, who might have been out.
Not really. We've been fortunate. I've not seen anything like that happen. I mean, most people, I mean, granted, they're later in the day, there's been occasional people that have had a little too much to drink, occasionally mm-hmm. wander into our audience. Yeah. That's been some interesting
situations. How do you handle hecklers in that case?
I have Archimedes. I don't have to.
Oh. Okay, well, that's
see,
nice.
And Archimedes is mobile. Archimedes is, he's got a, mm-hmm. You know, the bird arm illusion. You know, so he's got the Archimedes on his arm, and he's a hooded, big hooded figure.
He's kind of like Dead Bob,
very much like Dead Bob, though that was never the design by any means. And he has been known to Chris has been known to quote that Dead Bob did not invent that form of puppetry, just in case anyone ever wondered.
Yeah,
it was around longer than he's been.
The Japanese had that, I think,
It's way back when. Yeah. But anyway, he will wander out into the audience and deal with it. Probably more applicable though is the little kid that mm-hmm. gets a little too belligerent or is disruptive and ruining the show for other people.
Yeah, set him down. Or?
He'll make a couple of comments, and he's on a mic, but the mic is under his hood, and he will wander out into the audience and then just lean over the kid. And if he addresses him first and that doesn't do it, then he'll flip the mic off and say, if you don't sit down and be quiet, we're going to have, you know, he'll pull him
stronger.
Yeah, much stronger in dad voice. He calls it dad voice, you know. there was that one time when, this is a good story, I wish he were here to tell it. We had a dad that wouldn't shut up. He just was oblivious to the fact that there was a whole crowd of people there trying to watch the show. No, I don't think he was drunk. Hmm. He was just being belligerent. He was just yak on his phone or something.
Okay.
And Archimedes is like, sir, we're doing a show here, you know, and he just kept on going. And sir, and he went, walked over and stood right in front of him and looked down and sir, we're doing a show here. And finally the guy got quiet, but he was not happy about it.
Okay.
And he may have said something else, even more cutting, but at the end of the show, when the kids line up to come meet the dragon, to pet the dragon, you know, the rabbit, the guy kind of stood at arm's length behind everyone and had his little kid with him.
Yeah.
That he had brought to take the show. And the little kid came up to pet the dragon. And you hear him telling the kid something along the lines of, now it just goes to show you that you don't have to take no blank from anybody, no matter who they are, even if that, from any man, even if that man is an owl.
Wow.
And he was like, wow, Archimedes cut really deep. He emasculated that guy. So, it was pretty funny. I don't know what his thing was. He didn't understand that he was, you know, ruining it for everyone else. So,
and then,
that's it. I mean, we've not had any, most audiences are great. They're there to have fun, and we're there to have fun, and that's what you do.
Sure. Yeah. I would just think that people, in costume act differently than when they're out of costume. It's just, I know, like, people,
they can be a little more rowdy. Yeah.
Yes. My point.
Yeah.
Yeah. And they start trying to talk with you in,
I mean, we are in the kids section. So we do get a lot of family audiences.
Sure.
I have some friends that were not families that we sort of said, hey, you should come to our show. Come to the 4:30 show. We try to get them in the late show in the day, because by then a lot of the kids are no longer there.
So you can have more of an adult
show.
And
we can do a little more. Yeah. We're a little more unbridled, so to speak.
Yeah.
There are some kids usually from the Renfair community that come out. They come out and they'll watch the show. You have to watch them because they know all the lines, because the jokes are scripted and everything's scripted. So they start calling out the lines before you're ready for them to.
Sure. Yep. And on the 4:30 show, it's still not like it's not rude or adult nor X-rated.
Oh, no, by any means. Yeah. No, it's totally children and family friendly. Yeah. Totally fine. It's just, the innuendo can be a slight bit more, and it's very, we're talking very minor, very clean.
Mm-hmm.
I could do the show in a church and not be feel bad.
Very,
you know?
Same thing. Yeah,
yeah.
Yeah. Now, do you use any of the same kinds of magic tricks in your Santa routine?
I haven't so far. Other than there was a few years back, I did some magic as Santa. I've not set up an offering, and I'm hired as sort of a high end corporate Santa, so I'm just there to be Santa and wear a really nice suit and do lots of photos. So that hasn't been the
really
case.
Kind of a photo op kind of a thing. You have the kids come and sit in your lap and tell them what you want for Christmas.
Yes.
Kind of
what
a
do
thing.
You want for Christmas? Get your photo and then all that.
Right.
So
it really is not a magic Santa.
Not a magic Santa. I did it a few years back for one or two shows, just because that happened to be the timing was right and someone asked, and I threw together, I had a couple of Christmas effects, but that was really back to the opposite of what we're talking about, where I went trick one followed by trick two followed by trick three. And ho, 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 I'm Santa. You know there really was no direct tie-in. It was a bit of a stretch.
Right. Now, I know Bill Palmer had traveled abroad, and he had performed Merlin in the U.K., and I think he may have in Germany. I'm not sure where all he has. Have you been anywhere else outside?
I have not. I've worked at about three or four different fairs. I visited a couple others as well. I visited TRF. I visited Scarby. My stage mates, the people I share the stage with, they're a performing act called Foolhardy.
Okay.
They do magic and clowning. They're medieval clowns, and they're good friends of mine. I've been working with them on the same stage now for like 6 years, 7 years, something like that.
Mm-hmm.
They performed at Scarby for many years. I went down and I would go visit them and other friends at Scarby. And also being a musician, I have friends within the Renaissance Festival community that know me as a musician behind the scenes after hours. And so I go and hook up with those people and we get together on music fronts.
Right.
I visit there, visit Texas Renaissance Festival. I perform at a small festival in San Marcos called San Marcos Celtic Fest. It's once a year. I do Merlin there. And I also am the entertainment director of a very small festival that's trying to get up and running. They're on their second year, called Evermore Fair. So I not only perform, but I also help, find the other acts and book the other acts. And we've done that now, year two. Just did that. And then I also worked at a fair called Avalon Fair in Kilgore, Texas. I did that about 3 years as Merlin, and they're an Arthurian theme fair. So that was kind of fun.
That makes sense. And
yeah, it was a good fit. But logistics, this sure would change its schedule. And so I couldn't be two places at once, even though I'm Merlin. I know it's that excuse. and so I couldn't continue that fair. And I also did this year for the first.
And they got somebody else who's taken that place?
They have other magicians. Yeah, they don't have a Merlin,
have a Merlin,
but they have other
per
magicians.
Se. Okay.
Yeah. I did do a new fair this year. Myself and my lady both went. And it was really awesome because I booked the job. And it was in Gainesville, Florida, and it's at Hogtown Medieval Fair, and they've been around for 25, 30 years, and they're on the Alachua County Fairgrounds there, but I hear they're going to be moving to a new venue, and it's a huge event. They've been there for years, as I said, and someone said that they alternate themes. One year is historical, the next year is Robin Hood, the next year is...
Oh, it's not the same thing every year.
...is Arthurian. They, okay. Yeah, every year alternates, but they they cycle between
among
those three different topics.
Mm-hmm.
And so the Arthurian year was up, and they were like, hey, we want a Merlin. And someone that I've made friends with in the Renaissance community said, hey, I know a Merlin.
Right.
And so they called me, which was nice. And we basically went and did a Disney vacation. And here's the beautiful thing is the show, it was booked. And then they went, oh, by the way, do you actually do any magic?
Well,
because I'm just going to walk around and be Merlin.
Yeah.
And I'm like, oh, well, as a matter of fact, that's the thing I do, it's probably stronger than my stage show.
Yeah.
It's just walk around stand-up magic.
Yeah.
You know, I don't do a great close-up show. So you did that for them, too. But just stuff in my pocket and walking around and interacting and doing all that. So I have, I did that, too, of course. And I also did their commercials. I did their voiceover for their commercials, which was quite a feat. They had 2 pages. The dialogue I had to fit on 1 page. Well, talk kid like a bell. And, you know, it was very fast.
Have you ever gone to storyteller events? I know that they have these festivals also, it's kind of like, I guess, bluegrass festivals and things, but there are storytelling conventions or events. Do you know what I'm talking about?
Yeah, I've heard of them and I know about them. I have an actress friend, Bernadette Nason. She was the clipboard lady in Miss Congeniality, I believe. And she is a professional storyteller. That's where she does a lot of her time when she's not acting.
That's especially.
It's especially. And I know they have all sorts of events like that. I am not a storyteller. Like, I don't off the cuff tell great stories. I'm not practiced at it, though I might be okay at it if I got into it. But yeah, I've never been.
Do they have a storyteller at the Sherwood Forest?
Yes, it's sort of changed. That person has changed. Nobody that I feel like is the storyteller.
Okay.
I feel like Saul Ravencraft is the best storyteller I know personally, and he's quite good at it.
He does tell very good stories.
Yeah, I mean, the fact great that he, stories.
When he curates that museum over there, the Museum of the Weird, just going through that.
You know, there's two sides to it. There's first off, you need to be a great speaker and a great storyteller in the way you tell the story, but then you need repertoire. And I can do this telling. I have the voice, I have the diction, all that. I don't have the repertoire. I just I don't know any stories, and I haven't learned any. And so I have another friend that isn't a performer that knows stories really well. And then, of course, Saul Ravencraft. That's many.
That is special kind of a thing. I was working with the Super Bowl as the magician, and whenever I had auditioned for being a magician, there was some guy who came in as a storyteller, and he had worked at some sort of Renaissance festivals or something. He had a staff and whatever, and that was his thing. And so during the Super Bowl, when I was doing some strolling magic, he was doing strolling storytelling. So, and it was very good, too. You know, and he had always had a good audience around him and everything. So, I mean, that was his profession, you know.
Yep.
So those people do it. That's why I was wondering, you know, talking about storytelling and kind of getting into that. I didn't know if that was something that you did also.
My storytelling, I mean, I'm a jack of trades, jack of all trades, master of none. Apparently can't even say that.
Yeah.
Working in filmmaking, working in video game production, and working as a composer and a musician, I play a bunch of instruments. I play, you know, piano and drums and guitar and classical guitar and bass and a little violin and I sing and, you know, so I have all these skills that come and go based on when I need them.
Mm-hmm.
Same thing with magic. I have skills within the magic that come and go. You ask, like, what tricks do I do in my show? Well, I was having a conversation with someone about that recently where, you know, I don't really do that many things. I do one or two little sleights, and I do a couple of contraption things, you know, kind of stage illusion things where I got to flip a button or whatever here and there. Most of it's just acting and doing the script and interacting with the audience. It's and by design, right? I don't need to do it there in that situation.
Right.
So back to my storytelling abilities. Most of those come from studying film. I taught film editing for a number of years, and I'll probably teach it again, where I sort of self-taught myself to teach film editing. I knew how to do the technical part of editing, you know, computers and video compression and all the technology and all that stuff.
Right.
I learned that on my own over years of being in the software industry as a composer. And as a composer, you're learning about emotion and highlighting emotion and making music that makes a scene stronger, either by, you know, something that is completely the opposite of what the scene is, or by something that goes along with it.
That drives the scene.
Right. To drive the scene. But back to storytelling, I just sort of figured that part out on my own. And so when I started teaching editing, I had to sort of backtrack and learn about montage and, all the historical ways of types of montage and the way that editing that films are cut. Right?
Sure, sure.
And then along with that, with storytelling comes the hero's journey, which in the article that Kent wrote, he references that in there, Joseph Campbell's Hero's Journey, which the quick way to explain that to someone is just say, watch Star Wars. It's Ulysses. You know, the guy leaves home, he goes on a quest, there's, you know, and the whole thing, and the return at the home, where he comes back at the end, the return of the hero at the end, and he has to shoot it through the axe handles, you know, shoot the arrow through the axe handles to get regain his place. And anyway, it's Star Wars. You know, the Star Wars follows the hero's journey almost perfectly.
Exactly. Yeah.
And so do many mythology, Greek mythology. So I had to learn about that in my process of storytelling. So all my storytelling learning has been sort of after the fact, as I figured out what I was doing, you know, past the technical. It's just like magicians. I learned how to do sleights and do tricks.
Yeah.
I learned how to be entertaining, but then I didn't really learn, like I learned the importance of being entertaining over doing great tricks way later.
And that's the bottom line.
You have to get out there and fail a while before you figure that out, right?
That's true. And that's the bottom line, really, what we've been talking about over there is just about of what is important within magic, and that is of making sure that you have that emotional hook and that's something that people will remember as well. So as we wrap up over here, that since it's called the magic word, so what is your philosophy of life? What is your magic word?
My magic word. Skeza bath void liptik masnazola. That's the magic word I use. Oh, but you mean philosophy wise. Yes. Yeah. Be true to yourself. Be true to others. Be honest with everyone. And always smile.
I like that.
I like that.
Yeah. Because you're smiling now.
I am smiling now.
Well, thank you very much, Mark. I appreciate you being my guest here.
It is my pleasure.
And so there you have it, ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls, moms and dads. There was Merlin Magician, also known as Mark Conley Wilson. There we go. Not to be confused with the another Mark Wilson.
And I have an IMDb for those that wish to look it up. IMDb, look me up, Mark Conley Wilson. And one last little plug.
Yeah.
I just did a feature film called, and I kid you not, this is the name of the film, Virgin Cheerleaders in Chains.
It's a feature film.
It is a feature-length film. Okay. It won a lot of awards at festivals, starting off with the best screenplay back I don't know what the year was. But anyway, it's now got distribution. It'll be here and there and everywhere at some point. And it's a meta-horror comedy. So it's a horror film that's meta. It's about making a film within a film. And it's a lot of industry inside jokes.
I'm sure people laughed when they heard the Texas Chainsaw Massacre.
In this case, the line, the title alone will sell it, is in the script, you know, because that's why the name is so outrageous.
Yeah.
But it's a good movie. Check it out.
Thank you very much. I appreciate you being the guest. So for the Magic Word Podcast, this is Scotty out. Well, thank you, Mark, very much for being my guest this week on the Magic Word Podcast. And I want to apologize, by the way, in the first part of this that I had mentioned that he was at Scarborough Fair, but actually it's Sherwood Forest Fair that is one of the Renaissance Festivals. There are all over the country here in the U.S. and I know overseas as well, because I remember talking to Bill Palmer about this. Of course, Bill Palmer, whose name was mentioned there as being a mutual friend of Mark's and mine and many of you as well who know him, who has been considered really the Merlin, has performed in different places around the world as well in that guise of Merlin the Magician. Well, anyhow, I thank you very much, Mark, for sharing your stories and also your wisdom. And I hope that some of you will get something out of this and perhaps go forth and do your own thing and find your own chi, your own character, if you will. I think that there is something certainly in this podcast. I hope that you got a lot of it out. Just kind of squeeze the juice, you know, from this podcast. Also, have to apologize a little bit. I'm using a little bit different microphone here this week since I'm recording this while I'm out of town and just using a different microphone. So the first part of this, I apologize for popping my peas and some of the noise that normally would have a much better quality sound. So those of you who listen to this podcast regularly know what I'm talking about. So it's probably a pretty good time here to wrap up this week's episode. Until next week, stay well, get booked, and remember to be honest with yourself and with others, and keep smiling. This is Scotty out.